Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Artists and Repertoire session on classical music. I'm Karen Fishman from the Library of Congress. Today's program, we have four speakers, so I thought we should start right away so everyone has enough time to present, and we'll, if we can, let's hold questions till the end of the session. Our first presenter is DJ Hook. His title of his presentation is Beyond Bebop, Contemporary Classical Music on Dial Records. And DJ Hook is head of the Northwestern University Music Library, where he directs all operations and is curator for special collections in music. He holds advanced degrees in music and librarianship from Bowling Green State University and Indiana University. Outside the library at Northwestern, he has been a fellow at the Kaplan Institute for the Humanities and is an adjunct faculty member in the Bynum School of Music. His research has resulted in two books, Steve Reich, A Biobibliography and Analyses of 19th and 20th Century Music, 1940 to 2000. He's also the author of several articles and reviews on 20th century music, jazz, and matters concerning the licensing and ownership of digital media. Recently, his liner notes for the Earl Brown Contemporary Sound series were published by Vergo and issued as part of an 18 CD collection of historical avant-garde recordings. Please welcome to the podium, Mr. Hook.
Thank you, Karen, and thank you all for being here. What I'll be presenting today is a somewhat abbreviated version of a longer article that I'm working on that really has a very big middle section, and I haven't quite found the end yet. But what I have here kind of will cover the basic narrative arc of the dial. Well, thank you. Of the Dial Classical series, it's a beginning, middle, and end, at least for the series. Best remembered for its groundbreaking jazz recordings, especially those by Charlie Parker, the Dial Record Company stands as one of the most prominent documenters of bebop as it emerged in the late 1940s. Under the direction of Ross Russell, Dial Records became a leading specialist in the developing bebop style, providing, as described by Jeffrey Wheeler, quote, the opportunity to hear Parker in mature form, making what quickly became recognized as important modern recordings. While Dial's identity will forever be associated with Parker and the other jazz musicians Russell presented, the company also released a number of significant recordings of modern classical music from 1949 through 1951. Though rooted in a compositional tradition distinct from the fiery improvisations of bebop, this series of 18 long-playing albums, known collectively as the Dial Library of Contemporary Classics, was no less revolutionary. Centered on the music of Arnold Schoenberg, but also including works by other innovators like Bela Bartok, Igor Stravinsky, and John Cage, the series offered an uncommon range of new sounds. Dial celebrated jazz recordings, particularly those by Parker, have been studied thoroughly and remain widely available. But the classical series, now mostly out of print and almost entirely forgotten, represents another productive period in the label's history. Building upon and extending the work of those who've carefully documented Dial's jazz output, and those are most especially Jeff Wheeler and also Ed Komara, my research aims to tell the story of Dial's classical catalog. I've drawn largely on original correspondence, diaries, and business files in the Ross Russell papers at the University of Texas at Austin's Harry Ransom Center. And in that research, I found that Dial's classical series was more than a peculiar departure from bebop, but in fact was a purposeful effort by Russell to document and promote another aspect of contemporary music. This slide here is a very sketchy discography of the series. The paper I'm working on has a much fuller discography with dates of sessions and everything. But this gives an idea, at least, of what the albums were in the series, the repertoire, and the dates that they were issued. Dial Records was established in early 1946 as an outgrowth of the Tempo Music Shop, a record store in Los Angeles that Ross Russell owned and operated from July 45 through the fall of 1946 when he sold the store in order to give full attention to Dial. In his biography of Charlie Parker, first published in 1973, Russell explains, quote, "The original idea at Tempo was to sell classic jazz to collectors, but hipsters and boppers soon invaded, and Tempo became a headquarters for followers of the new music. One hipster was musician Lou Gottlieb, then studying composition at UCLA with Arnold Schoenberg. Russell recalls, quote, Gottlieb loved to discuss the merits of the two greatest musical minds of the century, Schoenberg and Charlie Parker. To meet the demand for bebop, Russell stocked the latest discs issued by a handful of small independent New York labels, such as Comet, Guild, Continental, and Savoy, of course. But when Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, and other top East Coast bebop musicians arrived in Los Angeles for a string of engagements, Russell recognized an opportunity and quickly started his own record company, Dial Records. Russell struck an agreement with Parker to record exclusively for Dial, and while getting to know each other, Russell learned that Parker's musical tastes reached beyond jazz, encompassing Stravinsky, Schoenberg, Hindemith, Bartok, Varese, and Elbon Berg. For Russell, Parker's interest in modern classical music almost certainly underscored connections already suggested by Gottlieb and foreshadowed the change in direction Dial would take a few years later. Between March of 1946 and February 1947, Russell produced four Parker-led sessions, interrupted by the saxophonist's extended stay at Camarillo State Mental Hospital, before Parker returned to New York in March of 1947. Soon after, Russell moved Dial's operations to New York as well. Quote, "When Bird went back, I had to follow," he later explained. Once relocated, he produced three additional Parker sessions during the fall and winter of 1947, but in the spring of 1948, and this was in the midst of the American Federation of Musicians recording ban, the 1948 ban, Parker's Dial contract expired. By the time the ban was lifted in late 48, Parker had signed with impresario Norman Granz, and thereafter all of Parker's new recordings were issued on the Granz-affiliated Mercury, Clef, Norgran, and Verve labels. For Dial, this was a consequential loss. Quote, "Once our contract with Charlie Parker came to an end," Russell said, "we lost what had essentially put Dial on the map." And this famous image, as it says, is from a Dial a jazz session in February of 47 in Los Angeles, and is reproduced quite a bit. It is, to my knowledge, the only photograph of Ross Russell with Charlie Parker. Parker's contract with Granz was signed in November of 1948, but Russell had been anticipating losing Dial's star for months. Early in February, in a letter to his mother, this is Russell's mother, Marguerite Russell, Russell predicts that Parker will be snapped up by a larger company once the recording ban is settled. Just a few weeks later, however, Russell sketches out an idea for taking Dial in a different direction. Quote, "I'm developing now a plan to launch in the classical field what Dial attempted successfully in the jazz field, build a catalog of non-commercial, off-trail, contemporary music." In a lengthy letter to Gottlieb a few days later, Russell confirms the new initiative. Since Russell is sure that sales of modern classical music will be restricted entirely to musicians and advanced collectors, a much smaller market than that for Dial's jazz recordings, he figures that the budget will necessarily be, quote, "pretty low for the actual recording dates, especially since there can be no compromise on the studio facilities or mastering or pressings." While carefully assessing the business aspects inherent to a program of contemporary classical works, Russell's newfound personal interest in the music itself was unqualified. Attending concerts regularly, discussing new music with the likes of Edgard Varese, and taking Henry Cowell's course on modern music at the New School for Social Research, Russell developed a broad knowledge of the repertoire as well as his own preferences. Though he enjoyed Bartok, Stravinsky, Ravel, Debussy, Hindemith, and Millau, Russell felt, quote, "The music of the Schoenberg School is still another level. Here the music not only sounds right, but it moves right. Something really happens." Russell's turn toward classical repertoire, he admits, is quite curious, but he credits bebop for opening his ears. He tells Gottlieb, quote, "For the first time in my life, classical music sounds right. I feel pretty confident that it was my exposure to bop that made contemporary classical music sound this way." With recording activities impeded by the nearly year-long ban, Dial's operations in 1948 were focused mainly on supplying jazz catalog titles to distributors and issuing new music by Parker and others from a backlog of recordings made during a flurry of pre-ban sessions. Additionally, Russell struck an agreement with the Blue Star Company of Paris, which issued jazz on the Blue Star label and classical music on the Classic label, permitting Blue Star to release a number of Dial jazz recordings. There were, of course, many Blue Star labels. This is Blue Star France, usually is referred to, but this was the first company established by Eddie and Nicole Barclay, if you're familiar with those names. In exchange, Dial obtained rights to issue various European jazz recordings, as well as an option for contemporary classical music produced by Blue Star. Similar arrangements were also made with Vogue in France and Metronome in Sweden. The earliest published reference to Dial's classical series appeared in the August 14, 1949 issue of Billboard, about a year and a half after Russell began considering the idea seriously. With Dial's success and reputation as a jazz label, this latest enterprise was news within the industry. I love that headline. Billboard's next mention of Dial's new venture did not come until early March 1950, by which time Russell had issued the first few albums. Though the series was recognized as, quote, an intensive program of contemporary classical recording on LP, the article also warned that Dial was heading into dicey territory by aiming at a coterie market and concentrating on avant-garde composers, quote, which most of the larger waxeries find profitable to avoid. This point was well made, since the major label's classical offerings in the late 1940s and early 1950s favored standard, mainly orchestral works, and dodged most contemporary music, particularly the recent chamber, solo, and vocal repertoire Russell was chiefly pursuing. Though Russell knew sales would not be great, he was encouraged by a growing number of acquaintances active in contemporary music. These included composers Peggy Glanville Hicks, George Antheil, John Cage, Lou Harrison, Igor Stravinsky, and through correspondence, Arnold Schoenberg. All assured Russell that he was on the right track. From December of 1949 through December of 1951, Russell issued a total of 18 albums in the Library of Contemporary Classics, with numbers 1 through 17 as individual 12-inch LPs, and 19 and 20 as a two-disc set. No number 18 was issued. In all, the series included 9 albums of new recordings produced and supervised by Russell personally, 6 comprised of licensed material produced by Blue Star or other companies, and 3 combining original and licensed recordings. Though Russell presented a range of repertoire previously unheard on disc, only 9 composers are represented in the series, with Schoenberg, whose music covers 6 albums, the obvious focus. Alban Berg and Anton Webern, both students of Schoenberg and practitioners of Schoenberg's 12-tone method of composition, together cover another 5 discs, so that 11 of the series' 18 albums feature works of Schoenberg or his immediate circle, commonly referred to as the Second Viennese School. I might also add that though John Cage was younger and certainly never thought of as part of Schoenberg's school, he also studied briefly with Schoenberg, making yet another connection. A brief statement, presumably by Russell, on the album jacket for Schoenberg's Chamber Symphony, number 2 in the series, announces, quote, "This is the first work of Arnold Schoenberg recorded in nearly 10 years, an unprecedented record of neglect of one of the great composers of the 20th century. This launches a program of recordings which will bring to the American public other compositions of this master, as well as his 2 leading followers, Alban Berg and Anton Webern." Since at the time just 5 commercial recordings of Schoenberg's music had been previously released in the United States, and of those, only 3 were commonly available, neglect was an apt assessment, especially considering Schoenberg's recognition by then as a musical innovator and even more so as a teacher of composition. Ultimately, Russell turned away from Schoenberg due to a personal falling out with the composer, which is a completely separate 20-minute presentation in and of itself, a very interesting story, but I won't be getting into that today. But it is noteworthy that Dial went on to issue more recordings of Schoenberg's music during Schoenberg's lifetime than any other label. By highlighting Schoenberg, Russell not only upheld music for which he had a personal affinity, but also set out to capitalize on an underserved, albeit narrow, market. Appealing further to specialized listeners, Russell used the best recording facilities available and sought instrumentalists, vocalists, and conductors who were particularly accomplished in the performance of contemporary music. From July 1949 to May 1951, Russell personally supervised 16 classical recording sessions, which is equal to the number of bebop sessions he had produced between 46 and 48. Most recordings were made at New York's WOR studios by Doug Hawkins, an expert engineer who also had recorded all of Dial's New York jazz sessions and, as a Juilliard graduate, was quite knowledgeable about classical music. I'll add, too, that Hawkins is also remembered for engineering most of the pre-Rudy Van Gelder Blue Note sessions. Most of those also recorded at WOR studios. Among the featured performers, many, such as percussionist Saul Goodman, violinist Rudolf Kolisch and Adolf Koldovsky, pianist Edward Steuermann and Mauro Ajemian, and conductors René Leibovitz and Robert Kraft, all had reputations not only for their musical skills, but also for their firsthand relations with the composers whose works they were interpreting. Regarding Kolisch, who had premiered many of Schoenberg's works and was even Schoenberg's brother-in-law, Russell boasted that, quote, recording Schoenberg with Kolisch is like recording Beethoven with Beethoven's violinist. Gunther Schuller, who played horn on the recording of Schoenberg's Wind Quintet, is another noteworthy musician who appears in the series. Schuller also held a greater role and served as Russell's unofficial advisor on artists and repertoire. For the series as a whole, sales were at first, according to Russell, okay in New York and Boston, but poor elsewhere. But he hoped reviews in the Saturday Review and the American Record Guide, High Fidelity, and other national magazines would bring wider exposure and interest. In the Saturday Review, Arthur Berger called the Bartok Sonata for Two Pianos and Percussion a, quote, very promising debut for Dial, noting the fine sense of its performers and the clear up-to-date reproduction. Publications catering more to scholars and professionals also took note, with Notes, the Journal of the Music Library Association, naming Dial, quote, the most uncompromisingly modern of all the small companies, and going on to say that the engineering is unusually good. While the series earned positive reviews, sales and revenue remained lacking. In April 1950, just a few months after launching the series, Russell observes, quote, the classical production and recording picture is far more expensive than jazz. By June, with 8 albums then on the market, he admits, quote, for the first time, I am heavily in debt. And these all come from letters home to mom, basically. Though he continued going to concerts, scouting repertoire, and tending to Dial's daily affairs, the business evidently unraveled precipitously over the ensuing months. In May 1951, he grumbles, quote, these records have been a gigantic failure. One specific loss, Russell cites, stemmed from two recording sessions devoted to works by Stravinsky. Dial's $5,000 investment for the two sessions brought a mere $1,300 in sales revenue. Bleakly, Russell concludes, quote, it has to get better somehow, or I am going to quietly fold it up, put it away, and just drop out of sight. By June of 52, all sales, classical and jazz, had fallen off to practically nothing. Other than picking up his mail now and then, Russell spent little time at the Dial office and took a job at a resort, allowing him to pursue his passion for golf while also earning some extra income. During a vacation in early 1953, he made a last attempt to revive Dial by branching into a new area and recording indigenous Caribbean music. The resulting Dial Ethnic series, these are 8 10-inch albums issued in the summer and fall of 1953, represents another concerted extension of Dial's activities beyond bebop and also deserves closer study. And I should say that while the classical series has sort of fallen into obscurity, the Ethnic series is even more obscure. These records are even harder to find. Russell ceased Dial's operations in June of 1954 and sold the entire jazz catalog to the Concert Hall Company, which marketed records by mail on its Jazz Tone label. Later, the recordings were acquired by Spotlight Records, which reissued Dial's complete bebop sessions on LP in the 1970s and then again on CD in the 1990s. While Russell sold off Dial's jazz holdings, he kept ownership of the classical catalog. In the 1970s, he received occasional inquiries from others wanting to reissue the recordings, and he engaged in some preliminary negotiations. Russell evidently also thought of reactivating the program himself. In an undated draft letter to distributors of Spotlight Records, again, Spotlight is the company that purchased the jazz catalog, and so he had a relationship with the distributors who were selling successfully the jazz catalog. In this undated draft letter to Spotlight distributors, Russell asks if there is any interest in having Dial's classical recordings available again. Boldly, he declares, quote, "These are essentially the," all caps, "the Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern recordings, which were greeted with much critical acclaim." He adds somewhat disingenuously, quote, "These records proved to be moderate, steady sellers and moderate volume." The draft trails off with a scribbled aside suggesting Russell had more than reissues in mind and was even considering making new recordings. He writes, quote, "Once the project is off the ground, I would add recordings of 1970s avant-garde music." Left unfinished and unsent, this letter appears to be a spontaneous run of ideas that were pursued no further. Summing up the Library of Contemporary Classics in 1995, a few years before his death in 2000, Russell said, quote, "The recordings, for the most part, received splendid reviews. They didn't sell, and the project was not a success." Well, true enough, Russell's terse assessment does not give adequate credit to the achievements of the series nor to Dial's broader legacy. Noted in its day for introducing curious listeners to unfamiliar music by Schoenberg and other 20th century composers, the series, despite its relative obscurity now, holds lasting value for capturing many authoritative performances that, had they not been recorded by Russell, would almost certainly not have been recorded at all. With a roster of musicians committed to contemporary repertoire and in many cases close ties to the composers being featured, the series chronicles how these works were then played and heard, most within no more than a decade or two of their creation. Beyond any interpretive insights and general historical perspectives, the Library of Contemporary Classics also demonstrates that Russell's intentions with Dial were greater than is typically recognized. Though he founded Dial wholly as a jazz label, Russell soon came to think of bebop, likely cued by Gottlieb and possibly by Parker even, as one of several modes of controversial off-trail, he used that term a lot, off-trail cultural expression. In a 1948 article on bebop, this was written after parting ways with Parker but before embarking on the classical series, Russell drew together contemporary jazz, classical music, and literature. Quote, "Any contemporary style, whether that of a James Joyce or an Arnold Schoenberg, remains controversial in its day, and bebop is no exception." Guided by this viewpoint, Dial's turn to recent classical music can be seen less as a departure from bebop and more as a measured change of course, as Russell followed another facet of contemporary music down a similarly adventurous and uncertain path. Thank you.
Thank you very much.